Until July 30, until midnight on July 30, there will be a pause on all construction, large or small.
Parts of Australia locked down again. It's Monday, July 19th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online. Find us at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Afghanistan's power vacuum. Health, a renewed concern in Afghanistan. Sanctions against Chinese companies. Vaccine tourism. And Olympic refugees. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Australia's biggest city, Sydney, has ordered a shutdown of building sites and most shops and is banning workers from leaving several COVID-19 hotspots. The city of 5 million people has been under lockdown since June 26th as authorities race to contain the spread of the Delta variant. The state of Victoria is also in lockdown. From Sydney, we hear more from Phil Mercer.
12 million Australians, or about half of the population, are in COVID-19 lockdown. In New South Wales, the most populous state, authorities recorded 111 new cases in the previous 24 hours, up from 97 the day before. Health officials have said that around 80% of the infections are from three areas in Sydney. In response, the government has imposed some of Australia's toughest lockdown regulations. Residents in the Fairfield, Canterbury, Bankstown and Liverpool areas, which have a total population of more than 600,000 people, will be banned from leaving their district for work unless they have jobs in the health or emergency services sectors. Those permitted to leave face compulsory coronavirus tests every 3 days, regardless of symptoms. The lockdown measures are in place until at least July 30. Companies that force staff to go to the office and don't allow them to work from home could be fined $7,400. Stores that can remain open in Sydney include supermarkets, pharmacies and hardware outlets. New South Wales State Premier Gladys Berejiklian says all building work must stop.
Now, the next decision was a difficult one. But until July 30, until midnight on July 30, there will be a pause on all construction, large or small. Non-urgent repairs, any form of building, renovation, construction, maintenance, including cleaners into the home or workers into the home, will not be allowed for all of Greater Sydney. We know this is a big decision.
Neighbouring Victoria State also reported a jump in daily COVID-19 cases to 19 Saturday, from 6 the previous day, raising fears it may extend a short lockdown that was scheduled to end on Tuesday. Once again, Australian states and territories are reimposing internal border controls on regions affected by rising numbers of COVID-19 infections. Australia has recorded 31,632 coronavirus cases and 913 deaths since the pandemic began. But its vaccination rollout has been slow compared to many other countries. Only about 10% of Australians are fully vaccinated. Most foreign nationals were banned in March of last year, and Australia's international borders are expected to remain closed until well into 2022. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Follow us as the story continues to develop. We invite you to stop by our Twitter stream at VOA Asia, Facebook at VOA Asia, and our website, voanews.com. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Thai police clash with protesters near government house. Japan landslide death toll rises to 15. Divers join search for 14 people in flooded tunnel in China. Sydney and Vietnam impose tighter COVID-19 lockdowns. Just in time for Tokyo Games, Olympic items up for auction. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and at the voanews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Let's continue with VOA Asia. The U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan is raising questions about who will fill the power vacuum left in America's wake. In Moscow, Kremlin officials are skeptically eyeing recent Taliban advances and how they might affect neighboring buffer states in Central Asia. Charles Maines reports from Moscow.
With U.S. troops heading home, Russian officials are publicly enjoying the moment.
The U.S. is not just withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. They are withdrawing, effectively admitting the failure of their 20-year mission.
Russian President Vladimir Putin initially endorsed the U.S. military operation, in part because the American presence de facto resolved Russia's own concerns about a terrorist threat in Afghanistan. But with the U.S. now on its way out, analysts say the Kremlin is openly worried that renewed fighting and masses of refugees could spill over into neighboring Central Asian nations, allowing Islamic extremism to spread in a region traditionally under Moscow's sway.
Thinking about its own security, Russia has absolutely no choice but interfere in Central Asian republics in case the situation there will be unstable.
In recent days, Russian officials hosted Taliban representatives for talks in Moscow, with both sides seeking security guarantees. Taliban negotiators claim their fighters now control 85% of Afghan territory, but ruled out attacks on Russian military allies like Tajikistan, with whom Moscow shares a collective security agreement. Yet already several thousand people have streamed across the border amid clashes with Afghan government troops.
Okay. Maybe Talib leaders are exaggerating when they say that they control 85% of territory. But their deployment on Tajik border is a real fact. They control Tajik border.
Meanwhile, political observers at home have been quick to point out the irony of the Kremlin negotiating with a group it officially deems a terrorist organization, even as it cracks down on Russian opposition groups like Alexei Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation, and what many see as a similar extremist pretext to ban members from fall parliamentary elections.
Navalny and his followers would never be allowed to gather in Moscow, but if you're the Taliban, why not? If that's what the authorities want, it's hypocritical and cynical. Even the Taliban is allowed to do what political opponents of the Kremlin are not.
Having fought its own deadly decade-long war in Afghanistan in the 1980s that ended in defeat, few think the Kremlin is eager to engage again militarily. But as the American role in Afghanistan ends, the danger is that spiraling circumstances on the ground could force Russia into entering the void. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
Happening now in Asia, at least 20 people have been killed in landslides triggered by heavy monsoon rains in the Indian city of Mumbai. Two others were injured after a wall collapsed on several slum houses. The injured were recovering in a hospital. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. The World Health Organization says health care is under siege in Afghanistan as the United States accelerates its troop withdrawal from the country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Afghanistan is one of the largest and longest-standing humanitarian emergencies in the world. The country is subject to almost every type of hazard, an escalating conflict, a rapidly spreading pandemic, and most recently a severe drought. The World Health Organization says 18.4 million Afghans need humanitarian assistance, a situation that has serious health consequences. It says increasing violence has led to more civilian trauma cases. The regional director for the WHO Eastern Mediterranean Regional Office, Rick Brennan, says there has been a 29% increase in civilian casualties in the first quarter of this year, compared to the same period last year. He says the arrival of people with complex war-related injuries is putting an enormous strain on health workers and facilities.
Moreover, this year there have been 30 attacks on healthcare across the country, including the total destruction of an immunization center late last month and a reported artillery attack on a health center in Kunar province just 2 days ago. As such, attacks are a violation of the right to health, They limit people's access to health care at a time of increased need, and they can contravene international humanitarian law.
Increasing instability has coincided with a quicker-than-expected pullout of American troops from the country. Brennan describes the current situation as fluid, fast-moving, and terribly concerning. He says many healthcare workers have left their posts because of security concerns, though some reportedly were starting to return.
So I think it is a mixed picture right now, but we are clearly concerned of decline in the access to healthcare. We're concerned about our lack of access to be able to provide essential medicines and supplies, and we're concerned about attacks on healthcare.
Brennan says the WHO is not in direct communication with the Taliban. However, he says the WHO has received indirect requests to continue to provide health services in districts taken over by the Taliban. He says he believes the WHO has a good reputation, particularly in areas where it has run polio vaccination campaigns. That, he adds, is likely to be instrumental in the WHO's ability to maintain a field presence in those areas. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Afghanistan says the daughter of its ambassador to neighboring Pakistan was briefly abducted and severely tortured by unknown assailants. A foreign ministry statement issued in Kabul condemned the incident. Kabul urged the Pakistani government to immediately identify and prosecute the perpetrators. You'll find all the big stories through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue with VOA Asia. The United States has placed sanctions on 7 Chinese officials in connection with Beijing's clampdown on democracy in Hong Kong. Washington also warned American companies about the risks of incurring legal and reputational damage if they conduct business in Hong Kong amid a shifting legal landscape in the former British colony. Speaking at the daily White House briefing on Friday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki had this to say.
As the president said yesterday, the situation in Hong Kong is continuing to deteriorate, and we continue to see Beijing assault Hong Kong's autonomy and democratic institutions. We've seen authorities use the national security law to make politically motivated arrests, and we've seen a general deterioration of fundamental freedoms, which were guaranteed by an international agreement. So that's why the United States, we announced steps we're taking today to promote accountability and transparency.
The Biden administration has been undertaking a comprehensive review of its policy toward China. The administration already has targeted officials and businesses it says are involved in human rights violations, including the treatment of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. The sanctions impose asset freezes and other penalties against officials who are with China's Hong Kong Liaison Office, which represents China's interests in Hong Kong. Shortly before the sanctions were announced, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian said at a regular news conference in Beijing that China will respond firmly and forcefully to the measures taken by the United States. Making headlines in Asia, China asked Pakistan to bring to justice the planners of this week's terrorist attack in the neighboring country that killed at least 9 Chinese workers. Premier Li Keqiang raised the issue with Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan by phone, stressing the need for Pakistan to use all necessary measures to investigate the incident and hold the culprits accountable. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, global inequality in the distribution of vaccines continues to hamper efforts to end the pandemic worldwide. But for those able to travel to wealthier countries with an abundance of vaccines, they are now willing to travel the distance and bear the high cost of vaccine tourism. VOA's Virginia Gunawan explains.
As health workers in the U.S. struggle to give COVID vaccines to Americans who are hesitant or even resistant, others around the world are not only willing to get vaccinated, but making the extra effort to do so. Suli Razak flew halfway around the world from Indonesia.
My children go to college here. After some consideration, we decided to get the vaccine in the U.S. while visiting our children.
Like many countries around the world, vaccine rollout has struggled to catch up with demand in Indonesia, currently experiencing a spike in COVID cases, including the more infectious Delta variant. So in June, along with her husband and 16-year-old daughter, Suli Razak boarded a 21-hour flight from Jakarta to New York. 2 days later, they got their first Pfizer shot at the local pharmacy in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania.
Before coming here, we've got some information saying that it was easy to get vaccinated. Turns out it was really easy.
Meanwhile, Angki Bangaditya, visiting New York City from Jakarta in March, managed to get the one-shot vaccine, Johnson & Johnson, just a couple days before heading back to Indonesia. The city had opened vaccinations to non-residents as part of attempts to boost tourism.
I wasn't sure I was going to immediately get it. I kept having to refresh the page for the appointment. It took 3 to 4 days to get a vaccination appointment.
At least 24 U.S. states do not require proof of residency for COVID-19 vaccination. For travel agents in Indonesia, this has become an opportunity to revive their businesses, hit hard by the pandemic. They are offering tour packages to get vaccinated in the U.S.
We have more than 30 people lining up.
The tour packages range from a $550 deal, a 4-day trip to Hawaii, to the luxurious 52-day cross-country trip costing $3,600. The availability of so many vaccines in the U.S. with a higher efficacy rate than the Chinese-produced vaccines primarily used in Indonesia is one draw for vaccine tourism.
The vaccine approved in such countries are like Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson. We don't have those in Indonesia yet. So I thought to myself, why not travel and get vaccinated at the same time?
Vaccine tourism also faces ethical concerns regarding access.
That does create disparities because the same people, same group of people from the country, some may be able to afford to do that while others would not be able to.
So far, the WHO Global Vaccine Sharing Program, COVAX, has shipped out at least 105 million doses to 135 lower to middle income countries. The anti-poverty advocacy group One Campaign notes that only 1% of COVID vaccines worldwide have gone to lower income countries and have called on industrialized countries to hasten vaccine sharing with the rest of the world. In Washington, D.C., Virginia Gunawan, VOA News.
The space tourism industry got a major boost aboard a billionaire's rocket ship. Plus, the EU lends Mother Earth a climate-conscious hand, and LeBron James suits up for the big screen. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us news from space.
Richard Branson, the billionaire founder of Virgin Group, made history as the wealthiest person so far in space. He rode aboard the Spaceship Two space tourism rocket after launching from the city of Truth or Consequences in New Mexico. Branson shared words of encouragement from space.
To all you kids down there, I was once a child with a dream, looking up to the stars. Now I'm an adult in a spaceship with lots of other wonderful adults looking down to our beautiful, beautiful Earth. To the next generation of dreamers, if we can do this, just imagine what you can do. Hey!
The 71-year-old Branson was among six crew members. The ship reached an altitude of 86 kilometers, allowing 3 to 4 minutes of weightlessness before landing back on Earth. The successful flight keeps Virgin Galactic on schedule to take paying passengers to space next year. The company already has 600 reservations with opening ticket sales carrying a $250,000 price tag. And while Branson says the billionaire space race isn't a competition, he changed his flight plans from later this summer after Amazon founder Jeff Bezos announced plans to ride his own rocket on July 20th. Launching on the 52nd anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, Bezos' company Blue Origin will carry him and three other passengers to space aboard the New Shepard spacecraft. With a net worth north of $210 billion, Bezos would then become the wealthiest person ever in space. Meanwhile, looking back at our planet, the European Union announced climate change proposals aimed at carbon neutrality by 2050. In short, that means balancing the carbon dumped into the atmosphere with carbon taken away. NASA scientists have for years warned that increasingly hot temperatures are rapidly melting the Greenland ice sheet among many impacts. Experts say those same hot temperatures deplete oxygen and water, killing fish during heat waves. The EU's plan could face years of negotiations, but leaders say the proposals will make it the world's first climate-neutral continent by the middle of the century. Representatives hope the U.S. and other countries will join.
What in the Matrix hell?
And finally, basketball superstar LeBron James stars alongside actor Don Cheadle in the new film Space Jam, A New Legacy. James reboots the original Space Jam movie that starred Michael Jordan. The film hits theaters and begins streaming Friday. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
The Tokyo Olympics get underway in less than a week. 29 elite athletes from 11 countries will comprise the International Olympic Committee's Refugee Olympic Team, which will compete at the Summer Games in Tokyo. As VOA's Laurel Bowman reports, it is only the second time in history that a team of refugee athletes will be competing in the Games.
These South Sudanese athletes are among the 29 athletes on the Refugee Olympic Team. They'll compete in the Summer Games in Tokyo that open on July 23rd.
For the 29 athletes that I'm going to lead, I think we will not miss a medal. We have also Popole for the judo from Brazil. We have this lady from Iran who's already have a medal in the taekwondo.
The athletes hail from 11 countries, including Afghanistan, Eritrea, Cameroon, and Iraq. They'll compete in 12 sports, ranging from swimming and boxing to badminton and weightlifting.
My expectation to all the refugees athletes is to do their best and also give the message of hope to all the refugees around the world because they are representing the entire refugee community in the world.
The Tokyo team was chosen from refugee athletes currently supported by the International Olympic Committee through a scholarship program. The IOC says it hopes the team will bring attention to the plight of the more than 80 million displaced people worldwide.
It's a message to the entire world to make the world aware of the magnitude of this crisis, which is growing every day. And it's also a message that these forcibly displaced people are an enrichment to all our societies.
A view shared by the athletes.
Showing the world that refugee also can dream and showing the world that refugees has goals. And even though they survived wars, they still are living their dreams.
It's just the second time in history that refugee athletes have competed in the Olympics. The first time was in Rio in 2016. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
That's our program for today. Thanks for joining us on VOA Asia. Continue online. We're at Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and of course, Facebook. We also thank our team, our one and only service chief, Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, Amy Hybels, and Chris Cascayo. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. Be safe. Be well.